Herzlich willkommen zum 112. Payment and Banking Podcast. Heute zur Abwechslung mal wieder in Englisch von Raphael und mir. Hallo Raphael, alles gut bei dir? Zurück aus USA?
Ach, wie immer gelandet und hervorragend gejetlaggt, ja.
Kennen wir. Bevor wir direkt unsere Gäste begrüßen, noch ein Dank an unsere Sponsoren, PayOne und Temenos. Vielen Dank für die Unterstützung. Und ja, hello, Catherine. So we will switch over to English. Nice to have you on the podcast. I think from our side, it will be a long time ago that we have an English one. So great to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much. Good day, everyone. So, and hello from London.
Yeah, work remit, or do you want just to start to give us a little intro, what you are doing and what is work remit's approach for our listeners? Because it's maybe not everybody is aware what work remit is doing. So I think a short intro would be great.
Yeah. Well, WorldRemit is an online money transfer business, about 7 years old, started in 2010. And the objective of the company was to permit people sending money back to their family and friends overseas to be able to do that online and in a quick and secure and fast way cheap way to do it. So our customers are mainly migrants who have come to the developed world to send to work and then to support their family overseas and to send the money, you know, maybe weekly or monthly back to their family and friends back in their home countries to pay for, you know, education, support, food, utility bills and hospital fees and so on.
Do you have some special corridors where the money flows go, or is it more or less all over the world?
Well, yes, we send from about 50 countries, so all over Europe, US, Canada, and Australia, New Zealand, and we've launched in a few more countries in the Asia Pacific region, like Japan and Singapore, and it's sending money to the whole of Africa, South America, and also Asia, and in particular the Philippines. Is a very important corridor for us.
Philippines as a receiving country, where does the money come from?
Well, from all over the world. Filipinos are, you know, kind of the GDP of the Philippines rely heavily on the money sent by their family, and they are more or less everywhere in the world, whether it's Europe, US, or even Japan or Australia. They're more or less in every single country, and in fact, each time we open a new country, I think the first transaction that we get is from a Filipino.
Okay, so, and just talking a little bit about building up a remittance business, what is from your perspective though the most challenging thing on your side to building up that business? So maybe you can tell us some stories about that.
Yes, well, the remittance business is obviously a regulated business. So as such, you need to first get licenses to be able to send money from wherever country you are. So, you know, the first step is obviously to get those licenses. So there's obviously a cost and time, and obviously some are more difficult than others. You know, in Europe for the moment, we are lucky that because of the European Union, we can what we call passport a license. So if you're licensed in one European country, you can passport your license to the whole of Europe. So that's been obviously very good. Compared to the US, which is, although it's one country, it's 50 states, and you have to apply for a license in every state. So the licensing aspect is, you know, time-consuming. And the other part of the business is to obviously open a distribution network. You know, if we're sending to all these countries, you've got to have partners in those countries who are going to pay out the money to the recipients of the funds. So, and the way that it's can be paid can be in a number of ways. It's obviously, there's what we call a traditional way where people can collect cash from a bank or a bureau de change. But now what we really, where Remit has been disrupted is really obviously opening a number of ways of receiving money. And one of them particularly is the mobile money, which has been really prevalent in Africa, for example. In terms of you know, the business itself, that is, as I said, is that distribution network, but then also is using the technology, and that's been again where Remit has been disruptive in terms of looking at how can you, you know, go online, do a transaction, and be as quick as easy, whilst maintaining the high level of compliance which is needed for a business like ours. So, you know, we've been using the technology which has progressed, you know, tremendously in over the last few years in terms of being able to identify customers, but making it so quick that, you know, people feel like more or less the transaction is done instantly and can be sent to their recipient in, you know, in a few minutes. So that's, you know, the three main parts of the convert there. Obviously, you need working capital for all that, because if you know, if you think that if you send a transaction, if you go on our website or down our app and do a transaction, and let's say you send 100 euros to the Philippines, but the 100 euros is already there in the Philippines, because we have to what's called pre-fund all our partners. So there's a big you know, working capital requirement as well, and that's why we you know, we had to kind of get some significant investment back in 2014 and 2015 from Accel in 14 with $14 million and TCV with $100 million in 2015. Both were kind of funds, VC funds from Silicon Valley and early investors in Facebook and Spotify and that type of companies.
Okay, quite interesting. So that's the money is mainly working capital money, to taking the risk on the one hand from the pre-funding source and on the other hand from the receiving source, that you have to cover the time where what the well, money yeah. flow really needs. So what is normally the time you have to cover? Is it a week, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days? Is there any numbers about that?
It depends how quickly you can send the funds to a specific country. You know, why it's needed is because most of our transactions are instant. So if you send you know, money today to a mobile wallet, for example, in Africa, you know, within a few seconds, the money is going to be deposited in the wallet in the recipient in Kenya, for example, through M-Pesa. So it's those, because of those transactions instant, you know, the distributor, the mobile money operator in that case need the funds to be able to pay that person instantly. So, you know, we send money every day to our partners. Obviously, I send some, it takes, you know, the next day or a couple of days. So it's, you know, generally you're looking at sometimes 2 or 3 days of working capital, yes.
How do you handle counterparty risk? I mean, one of the biggest risk factors that you would have is obviously that you have illicit funds running through your platform, which I agree with the advances that we have in KYC technology should be at least on the sending end should be manageable or even faster than the, what we had before. But how do you handle counterparty risk on the other side? So what's your normal time frame before you start partnering with somebody to make sure that you don't run into that problem?
Well, you know, we only work with, you know, kind of regulated, licensed and well-known, established, you know, kind of partners. So most of our partners tend to be banks, which are regulated, licensed, you know, financial institutions like Bureau de Change or microfinance institutions. So all mobile operators, which are, you know, kind of well-established and licensed. So we obviously go through a process of what we call onboarding a partner, which is, you know, going through obviously their credit risk, but also who they are, who the owners of the business are, and going through all the various checks. So it's quite a detailed check, and to be frank, they do the same on us as well. That's a kind of both ways, but you know, that's one way of making sure that you're dealing with partners. Obviously, you know, in terms of compliance, the work is working as a partner. We check obviously the standards, but to a certain extent the risk. But they also do, you know, their work, and we work together. If there's ever any concern about the other sender or recipient, obviously they would notify us, and we would work together to investigate.
How do you monitor that on a day-by-day basis? I mean, one of the reasons why cross-border transactions are taking usually so much time is that even though you might have, I don't know, with some Filipino bank, you might have dealings maybe once or twice a year if you are a normal non-remittance-focused bank. How do you monitor these kind of maybe even smaller players popping up, going to yourself and saying, oh, by the way, I think that you're an interesting partner. The one thing is go for through the first way of checks, but is there something that you have like a monitoring process if something gets funky?
There's a number of monitoring. Obviously, in terms of the partners we work with, you know, we monitor them, you know, kind of not just at onboarding, but all the time. We have regular reviews, and obviously we establish the risk of the partner. You know, the bigger banks are obviously less likely to be risky than maybe a smaller bank, but we keep that, you know, in mind all the time. We have alerts, you know, telling us any news that we may have on those partners. We also have a look in a number of countries. We have a lot of people, you know, working for us in those countries, so they obviously keep aware of what's happening. But, you know, in terms of, you know, the transaction we do generally are small transactions. You know, we're talking of people supporting their family, so paying out of their wages, you know, a sum to support their family. So you're looking at small regular sums, you know, to generally one or two recipients, maybe up to five, depending on the extended family. And, you know, we monitor the transaction on both sides, and therefore we have a very quick way to identify, you know, unusual patterns, which will obviously look to be doing an investigation if we felt that, you know, there was something strange or unusual.
Makes sense. Now, one of the things that that I think sets you apart from a lot of other people is that you're trying to evade as much as possible cash as a funding method. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, we don't have we actually don't take any cash at all. So that's what's been, you know, the difference between us and the traditional players. Straight away went for non-cash from the send side. So we don't accept cash. We only accept, you know, money through a bank account or a debit card, which has the funds are kind of identified by the bank, and the person has already been KYC'd by the bank, and we carry another check. So, you know, we've got full visibility. And that's why, in fact, the banks, which like our model, if you think in the remittance business, a lot of smaller business or the more traditional business have been closed down by the banks because they didn't want to work with that type of business because of the cash element. But we've been, you know, able to maintain and open bank accounts in countries which have been quite difficult generally for the remittance sector because of our, you know, online model, not taking cash, and very high level of compliance systems.
On the payout side, how much of your business is cash on that one? Because I assume that you can't really remove to zero the payouts of cash, right?
Yeah, you're correct, because obviously in some countries, you know, the only method that people can receive money is cash because they don't have a bank account. You know, if you think in most of the world, if you look in Africa, for example, less than 20% of people have got a bank account, so they're totally financially excluded. So the only way to receive is cash. But, you know, that is decreasing with the emergence of mobile money. We have found that the level of payout in cash has reduced drastically for us. You know, when we started 7 years ago, it was 100% payment in cash, but now we find that only 30% of the payments are actually in cash, because, as I said, people have got other methods like mobile money. Mobile money has really changed the face of remittances in terms of bringing people into some kind of financial system, financial inclusion, and allowing them to, you know, if you think of a mobile money, mobile wallet, it's like a bank account but on your phone. and they have to be KYC. You know, when they get their SIM, to register their SIM as a for a mobile wallet, they have to come present their ID, and therefore there's a, you know, it's much safer as well, better audit trail from a compliance point of view, but also allows people to receive money instantly and not having to carry cash, which is much safer in most countries, but also be able to kind of, you know, use it as they need rather than holding that cash somewhere and, you know, maybe losing it.
So that means you always have the strategy to cooperate on the sending and receiving side with local banks or wallets and not building that stuff on your own. Or is there a situation where you think it could make sense that WorldRemit itself becomes a mobile wallet or bank-like structure to extend your value chain? What is your strategy about that?
Well, on the receive side, no, as you said, it doesn't make sense for us to build a mobile wallet, a WorldRemit mobile wallet, because the operators are already there. And what we do is work with them, help them, and maybe some of the smaller operators, we can, you know, with our experience, help them to kind of develop the mobile wallet and you know, they can actually expand their services. On the send side, you know, it depends on the country, but in most countries now, especially, you know, like in Europe or the US, people have got a bank account which they can use, you know, on their, they have an app generally on their phone, so they can actually transfer funds from their phone. But it's true that, you know, more and more people are using, you know, social kind of network to correspond with their kind of family, friends. And, you know, there's now an emergence of using those social networks to make payments. And, you know, we've seen WeChat and other kind of, especially in China, using those services. So that's something that we're definitely looking at. And it might not mean that we need to develop it ourselves, but more working with those networks who kind of have developed those services.
Yeah, but that means at the end, especially in areas where you have a lot of underbanked people, you're acting more or less as a lead generator for the local wallets, or?
Well, yes, but, you know, there is competition you know, if I look at Africa, generally there's several operators who offer, you know, mobile wallets. So there's a fair competition in those countries. So it's not just one wallet. And what we do is we're trying to connect to all the wallets. So we're not exclusive. We don't, you know, we believe in competition. So we don't go for exclusivity. That was, you know, the way that some of our competitors have worked in the past, and we don't believe in that. So we don't go for exclusivity. We want to work with everybody to allow our customers to be able to have the choice and be able to receive money quickly and as low cost as possible.
Yeah, so at the end, as far as I see the remittance market, you have two types of target groups, and we are talking about these, I think, migrants-related target group who are sending money abroad. Do you also target the other target group, so the normal local client who wants to send money to the US or whatever, which is not a recurring or subscription-based business, or is that not a target group for you?
Well, we do serve that market as well, but it is true that, you know, kind of the majority of our customers at this stage are very much, you know, kind of migrants sending money back home. You know, this is a big industry. You know, if you think there's probably more than $500 to $600 billion being sent every year in the form of remittance. You know, we do bank deposit in all the countries you mentioned, US, Europe, and so on. So we do have, you know, the more other expat or people just wanting to send money to pay a bill or something like that. But I have to say, this is not the majority of our customers at this stage. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, we might develop further as we go along. But we still, you know, our focus is still delivering a product for the migrants sending money back home.
Yeah, so one question in that direction. If you say you're targeting mainly recurring transactions. Your business model is more or less cost per transaction, as far as I would assume. Do you think that a different model, for example, flat fee recurring fees per month, is a model which could also generate a quite good lock-in effect for you to come away from these? You only get money if someone's sending money abroad.
I think, you know, the there's a lot of competition in the various model, and you know, certainly for the one you were describing in terms of sending money to, you know, let's say to the US to an account to pay a bill or so on. There's, you know, a number of companies concentrate on that. As I said, we tend to concentrate on the market, and there's generally a movement, you know, which is led by the World Bank and other G20 government to reduce the cost of remittance. You know, up to now it was very high. You know, it was obviously there was very few companies operating in this sector, and the cost, you know, could be up to 20% of the amount sent. This has, because of competition, has reduced, you know, drastically, and it's probably, you're talking of probably to 7 to 10% these days. We are lower than that, and we're working, you know, to kind of reduce the cost as much as possible, and working, you know, with all the bodies to kind of work with that. And as I said, that's why I think competition is very important. You know, if you think, you know, remittance is the amount of remittance in the world is 3 times higher than the global aid, overseas aid, and that's why the importance of remittance is extremely great, because of what it does. It goes directly to people to support them, whether, you know, as I said, it's food, to education, to housing, to hospital. Whereas, as we know, aid, a lot of money is lost on the way and doesn't always achieve what it's meant to be. So the importance of remittance is vital to support, you know, and develop a country. And, you know, it helps also families tend to send money to help their family set up new business, to cover. And I say education is very important in Africa and in other places, because that means that's a way to get out of poverty. So, you know, the cost of remittance has been a subject which has been discussed, as I said, at the G20s and the World Bank and other, you know, United Nations, to try to reduce it as much as possible in order to help people, because it really goes and help the people who need it. And therefore reducing the cost means that more money will be sent to those people.
Okay, so one discussion we always have in our round at the payment and banking people is remittance. From your perspective, is it a standalone product, or is it a feature, or is it both? How you want to would you classify it? Is it from an end user perspective, or from a user perspective? Do you see it as a commodity feature or a standalone product, or is it both, depending on the target group?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would describe it as a commodity, but certainly, you know, the remittance does serve a specific sector, you know, the way I've described it, and it meets, you know, a specific need that, you know, people need to send money, and the banks, you know, have never been able to provide that service for various reasons. And I think, you know, it is a fairly specific market, and, you know, the I was mentioning, you know, the level of remittance earlier. You know, this sector has been, in a way, also quite informal. You know, up to recently, there was still a lot of money being sent, what we call informally, i.e. people carrying money with them or sending in an envelope or asking, you know, giving money to someone here, what we refer to as awala, and then getting someone else to pay in the country of destination. With obviously the increased terrorism and the step to against anti-money laundering, that informal market has become more formal, and therefore, you know, the market is bigger and needs to be provided for.
When we look at Germany or the German-speaking market, how do you see the market for you? Is it already crowded with competition? Is there a niche or a market entry strategy where you can say, hey, that makes sense to target Germany? Or are there maybe specific money flows or money corridors where you said, okay, these corridors I only can cover when I cover Germany. Is there any special about Germany?
Yes, well, you know, we see Germany a very important market for us. You know, it's been growing over the years, and certainly we've put a bit more focus on it than we did in maybe initially. You know, when we are, you know, kind of a young company, the world is big, and therefore you can't always concentrate on it.
That is always the challenge in young companies. Too much opportunities and focus on the right one.
That's it. But certainly Germany is a very much a focus for us. You know, we've been spending a bit more time and marketing effort to kind of target, customers. Obviously, you know, be online, you have to, kind of make your product known. But certainly we've seen the growth. Yes, there are competitors, but you know, we are unusual in terms of the range of products we offer and the reach. You know, we are in many countries and adding countries all the time in terms of destination countries. We have a product which works quickly, which is safe and easy. We've got an app which people find very easy to use. If you look at the app review generally, you find it's a very high rating. So and all that, and the company. And I think, you know, the mission of the company, our CEO and my co-founder is African, and so people can relate to that. You know, we really understand our customers, and I think there's that element as well that people like the company for that.
So just not wondering why Raphael disappears. He had problems with his micro. He maybe come back. So otherwise we make it. We continue. One thing I'm wondering about is when you see the remittance market, no matter which country or which corridor, are you taking away remittance volume from existing more or less old school players like MoneyGram and Western Union, or do you generating a new market that means the remittance overall is growing and you're taking part of this growing area of the remittance business? Do you have an idea about that?
Well, obviously the informal one is difficult to kind of assess, but definitely we will be taking some of that, especially when people see that actually it's safer to send money through us rather than giving cash to someone to take on the bus and carry it and far, much faster as well and cheaper. But it's true that also we are taking business away from, you know, the more traditional business because, as I said, generally they've been quite expensive but and also slow at moving and not, you know, and to be fair, they're suffering the same problem as maybe banks are suffering in terms of they've got legacy system, big network of agents which they cannot just get rid of, and therefore it's for them, it's difficult to move to a much more, you know, agile kind of environment like us. You know, we started 7 years ago with a blank page, and you know, we could go straight away, use technology, which a lot of other organizations are not able to just switch to because of legacy systems.
You're just mentioning costs and speed of transactions. Are there any other main aspects of the product where you said, okay, that's different than the other players, or is it mainly cost and speed to compare your product, for example, with Western Union or also with the companies like Azimo or TransferWise?
Well, obviously, you know, people will not just kind of use a company just for because it's cheaper. There's obviously, you know, there's a big element of, you know, kind of trust. You know, they are sending hard earned cash to support their family, so trust is very important. So building the trust and knowing that, you know, what we are trying to do for our customers is very important. And, you know, we have a very big social commitment and social network of us through Facebook and so on, and, you know, kind of really liaising with our customers and kind of being close to our customers. Obviously, cost is very important because, as I say, if they can send more to their family, then obviously it's important. I think, you know, it's everything. So it's cost, it's safety, it's trust, it's the speed at which, you know, the fact that, you know, you can send without friction. So if, you know, if you can, the transaction is easy, but at the same time, if you need to speak to us and you can call us and you can solve the problem very quickly, that's important as well. So it's a whole package which, you know, people look at.
Okay, Kenya, so what I'm interested in is so where did your journey go through? So what are your next steps, at least in the next 6, 12, maybe 18 months? I know for a startup, it's hard to estimate anything which goes beyond 24 months, but at least some ideas where your journey can go through, or areas where I said, okay, we want to cover this area, but at the moment we are on a way to cover it, but not right there. Is there a vision or a roadmap where you can share with us?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, the first one is obviously to develop our network further. So, you know, I said earlier, the world is a big place. And although we, you know, we are a global company, we still have, you know, quite a few territories we have not covered. So that's certainly, you know, kind of a focus of ours to both to expand the send countries as well as the distribution network in terms of the receive countries. So, and always improve it all the time, so we've got a big focus on that. But obviously, you know, it's looking at partnerships and how we can, you know, make life easier. You know, we talked about, you know, kind of, how you could send money through your via the social networks and so on. So that's things that we're looking and talking to the various, you know, players in the market, and that's certainly and any other partnership with, you know, maybe even banks and other players who kind of feel that, you know, they cannot do it themselves and therefore looking to provide a service to their customers and you know, using maybe our services.
So one last question from my side. If you have any, just let me know, or points where you think we should discuss. But one thing I'm was curious about. So how do you see? In the last weeks or months, there was a lot of discussion about cryptocurrencies, blockchains, and things like that. How do you see these? Let us call us technologies or developments in the context of remittance. Could it help to make remittance better? And if yes, in which area? Is it maybe a technology to make transactions cheaper? Is it a funding method or receiving method or both? Or do you think it is not relevant at all in your context? How do you see it?
Well, there's a mixture of things, you know. Can't say it's not relevant at all. You know, in some country where, you know, you don't even have the internet and you are, you know, in the middle of the jungle of Congo, it's probably not that relevant. But I think there's definitely, you know, something we're looking at. There's still a lot of work on those cryptocurrency and in terms of compliance and the kind of understanding how it works and making sure there's full visibility. And so that's still kind of, you know, and a lot of governments and regulators are still struggling with that concept. Blockchain has got, you know, potential, especially for funding, and, you know, even our partners is something that we're looking at. So there's definitely, you know, things that we're looking at could become relevant. It's going to be a slow process because, you know, there's as I said, this environment is very regulated, and generally regulators do move a little bit slower than, you know, technology. So there's need to be looking at how it works, and so a bit of work to be done.
Sure, for sure. It's still a technology, or still both technology use case, which is still a hype and not so main market, mainstream anymore. One other point. Sorry for adding another question. So in Germany, or not in Germany, in the EU, we now have PSD2, which could help certain companies to be more open and extended business. How do you see your business related to PSD2? Did it help you to extend the funding methods to manage the risk, or how do you see it, at least from the side where you have to deal with EU-based companies or clients or customers?
Well, I think, you know, the PSD2 is affecting, you know, probably the banks most, where they, you know, they're going to find it, you know, difficult probably to challenge, you know, the new entrants in the market like ourselves in terms of remittance. At the same time, there's probably an opportunity to work with them and to provide them with help or services to kind of to help them to adapt. And you see that in a lot of the kind of mainstream bank, sometimes even buying some of all those challenger banks to kind of have an arm which is, you know, kind of digital, and they kind of deal with the more traditional products through the retail bank, but then looking at those challenger banks to provide, you know, the retail, the customer kind of product that, you know, people are looking for now. You know.
Okay. Do you have, maybe it also relates to the PSD2 context, do you also have an API white label strategy if maybe someone else wants to integrate you into his somewhat technology environment, for example, a challenger bank? We have this cooperation between N26 and TransferWise, for example. There are a lot of other challenger banks popping up in every country around the EU. Everybody of these banks needs partners to extend his product portfolio. That could be a good thing for WorldRemit to extend its reach. How do you deal with that case?
Yeah, we're talking to a lot of banks. So, as I said, this is something which has come, you know, now much more relevant and on top of the agenda of many banks to come say, okay, how can they offer a service to their customers? And obviously, as I said, it's difficult for them to adapt their system, and therefore the best way, the cheapest way, and the quickest way is to go into partnerships. So definitely something we kind of looking at.
Okay, good. So I think that was it from my side. Sorry that that Rafael was not available due to some tech reasons. Anything else from your side you want to point out to our listeners, which we not covered in our questions before?
I think we've been quite extensive into cover most things. I can't think of anything else at this stage. Thank you.
Okay. Dorthin, thanks okay. for your time.
Thank you very much.
We make now a short break and then go over to the news. So, but I put on stop here that you can upload your file. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye. Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Das war so. So, Rafael wieder da. Du hattest leichte Mikroprobleme, deswegen hatten wir dich im WorldRemit-Teil nicht mehr so gehört. Aber zu den News bist du wieder da.
Zu den News bin ich wieder da. Ich bin quasi wieder aufgewacht.
Ehrlicherweise Viertelstunde hingelegt und mich reden lassen, kenne ich schon. Zur Strafe fängst du mit den News an, es hilft nichts.
Genau, wir hatten einen sehr interessanten Gastbeitrag von Moritz Königsbischer bei uns auf dem Blog. Was ist eigentlich 3D Secure und was ist dabei wichtig zu wissen? Moritz hatte mal probiert aufzuschreiben und ich finde es sehr gut gelungen, der Artikel. Warum brauchen Händler 3D Secure? Was sollten sie dabei beachten? Ist 3D Secure der Heilsbringer, die Diskussion, die wir ja auch gerne mal zwischen uns führen. Wer braucht das eigentlich, diese Phishing-Attacke, und wann kommt endlich mal was Neues? Sehr lesenswert, nicht nur für die Interessierten aus der Payment-Branche, natürlich auch gerne für die Händler. Einfach ein differenziertes Bild auf 3D Secure.
Ja, vor allem für die Händler, glaube ich. Und mal wichtig, da ein bisschen weiter reinzugehen und wegkommen von dem Level per se alles scheiße bei 3D Secure und ruiniert alles, weil wie oft ist halt die Sichtweise ein bisschen differenzierter am Ende. Ne? Es ist nicht alles scheiße, aber auch noch lang nicht gut.
Genau. Passend dazu eine relativ aktuelle Meldung. Number26 hat eine eigene 3D Secure Implementierung vorgestellt, die halt genau das probiert zu machen, ein wenig differenzierter, nicht nur Baseball-Keulen-Einsatz, entweder alle oder keine, sondern differenzierter ein Riskmodell auffallen zu lassen, wann 3D Secure angefragt wird oder nicht.
Ja, die interessante Frage, und das ist jetzt schon ein ziemliches Payment-Nerd-Thema bei 3D Secure, ist, das ist ja auf der einen Seite gut, dass ein Issuer in dem Fall wie Number26 eine bessere 3D Secure-Implementierung hat, das muss aber trotzdem ja noch von den ganzen MPIs und so weiter auch integriert werden. Oder ist aus deiner Sicht das automatisch jetzt überall besser, wo ich eine N26-Karte einsetze?
Na, meine Hoffnung wäre natürlich Letzteres, aber du hast natürlich recht, am Ende des Tages müssen sich alle dran halten. Und im schlimmsten Fall wird ein MPI sagen, nö, ich verlasse mich einfach drauf, da ist 3D Secure enabled, also mache ich das einfach an. Also die Hoffnung ist natürlich, dass sich so etwas, Number26 macht ja gerne auch mal so den Leuchtturmcharakter und zeigt mal, was alles so technisch, nicht nur technisch, sondern eigentlich schon seit ewig und drei Tagen möglich wäre. Aber sie machen es halt mal vom Kunden her gedacht. Hoffen wir doch mal, dass es mal die Leuchtturmwirkung hat und dass sich andere Leute dann auch angucken, was man denn damit mit 3D Secure noch alles machen könnte.
Genau, weil, und das passt auch zum Moritz-Artikel, man hätte es auch jetzt schon viel besser machen können, aber da liegt es eher an den Issuern, es richtig umzusetzen und nicht an 3D-Secure per se. Ja? Und vielleicht haben wir da mal eine ganz gute Beispielimplementierung, von der sich auch alle anderen ein bisschen was abschauen können.
Genau, genau. Dann hat unser, wir reden ja fast jedem Blog, Podcast inzwischen ja leider und oder zum Glück über Amazon, hat Amazon ein relativ interessantes System vorgestellt, nennt sich Amazon Pay Places. Pay Places ist also nichts anderes als der Versuch von Amazon, mit der Amazon ID auch offline zahlen zu können. Sprich, ich bin also, ich gehe in, keine Ahnung, den Strickladen um die Ecke, der auch noch seine Stricknadeln über Amazon verkauft, und der hat jetzt die Möglichkeit zu enablen, dass ich über meine eh vorhandene Amazon App auf meinem Telefon quasi dann auch noch offline damit bezahlen kann, weil mich das per Geofencing nämlich erreicht und sagt, hier übrigens in dem Strickladen um die Ecke kannst du auch mit deiner Amazon ID bezahlen. Und ich kann das Ganze quasi auf der Amazon App fertig machen, also keine neue App, keine neue Credentials, weil alles gespeichert, und kann plötzlich offline bezahlen.
Was hat der Händler auf der anderen Seite? Ist das irgendwie so WeChat-mäßig mit QR-Code lesen, oder hat der Händler eigentlich gar nichts? Dann muss er irgendwas haben, oder?
Er muss halt in Anführungsstrichen, er hat auf seiner Amazon-Händler-Seite hat er eine Möglichkeit, quasi das Payment zu requesten, und ist also so ein bisschen ähnlich wie PayPal, das man mit den QR-Payments versucht hat im Offline-Bereich. Was aber relativ interessant ist, PayPal hat das damals zumindest hier in Deutschland über eine extra App probiert, so mit Einchecken, Auschecken und sonst irgendein Krimskrams. Das Interessante hierbei ist, dass tatsächlich in der Standard-Amazon-App eingebaut wurde, was halt einfach schon zeigt, dass da jemand zumindest mal relativ long geht auf dem Thema und guckt, wie das funktionieren könnte.
Ja, er nimmt es halt ein bisschen ernster und sagt hier, weil wenn die App nicht funktioniert, nur dafür schmeiße ich sie halt wieder raus. So ist es als Feature in der Standard-App App drin.
Genau.
Das ist halt ein ernsthafterer Approach.
Ja, ja. Plus der Start- und Launchpartner ist TJ Fridays, also für alle, die Barbecue-Ribs und Steaks und ähnliches und Chicken Wings haben wollen. Das zweite Feature, was quasi mit dabei ist, ist Order Ahead Pickup in Store. Sprich, so ein bisschen, was ich gerade in den USA gemacht hatte, erstaunlicherweise wieder nur ich war und alle anderen nicht. Der Klassiker bei Starbucks, du bist 5 Minuten entfernt, weißt, dass du da eh gleich ankommst, machst das Order Ahead, sagst, du willst deinen Kaffee haben, gehst rein, gehst zur Ausgabe, sagst, wo ist mein Kaffee, die gucken dich an, sagen, bist du Raphael, sagst ja und tschüss und gehst mit deinem Kaffee raus, und alle anderen gucken dich ein bisschen frustriert an, weil sie dann 5 Minuten in der Schlange stehen. Also genau das gleiche geht dann quasi mit Pay Places und TJ Fridays. Du sagst, wir wollen Rips für auf dem Weg nach Hause, du machst das Order Ahead in der TJ Fridays App, bezahlst auf deiner Amazon App, indem du bestätigst, dass du Ribs haben willst, fährst ran, packst die Packung ein und fährst nach Hause und hast Hunger. Könnte, also weiß ich nicht, ob das im Offline-Store etwas ist, also offline für jedes Offline Use Case unbedingt sinnvoll ist, aber für den Order Ahead und Pay Online ist das natürlich etwas, was extrem interessant sein könnte und natürlich ein kompletter Angriff auf Square ist, die ja genau das probiert haben zu etablieren.
Ja, und mal ein greifbarer Use Case für das Buzzword, wir machen jetzt Omnichannel, weil genau das ist ja Omnichannel, was da passiert.
Und ich finde, und da bin ich ein bisschen bullish, Amazon hat halt einfach den Loyalty-Faktor. Also genauso, wir wissen alle, dass die Starbucks-App am Ende des Tages das Nonplusultra im Mobile-Payment ist und auch im Order-Ahead und Pickup-in-Store ist. Den Loyalty-Aspekt, den du hast mit einem Amazon, den Recurring-Usage-Point, den du hast mit einem Amazon durch Prime. Ich kann mir durchaus vorstellen, dass du früher oder später, vermutlich in den nächsten paar Wochen und Monaten, schon so etwas haben wirst wie Rips Tuesday oder Rips Thursday, ja, wo dir die Amazon-App sagt, hey, willst du nicht bei TJ Fridays vorbeifahren? Du kriegst als Prime-Kunde heute 10% Rabatt und bezahl doch einfach hier. Also genau diese Kombination aus Amazon Loyalty, Prime als sehr erfolgreiches Loyalty-Programm, wo du halt auch Recurring Usage hast und 30% Overspend im Gegensatz zu einem anderen Ding. Und dann jetzt große Retail-Partner, dann vermutlich auch im Resto- und im Gastro-Bereich. Das ist eine Kombination, die, glaube ich, extrem spannend und gefährlich werden kann.
Ja, ja, das ist oft so am Schluss nichts Neues. In dem Sinne haben wir auch viele Startups und so auch in Deutschland schon mal probiert. Aber über genau das, was du sagst, die Reichweite von Amazon und die Loyalty, kommen da halt die Leute drauf. Ja? Also kriegst halt dadurch die Masse hin und kombinierst es halt mit Payment noch dazu.
Gut. Ansonsten gab es, eigentlich ist eine schwache Woche, man merkt so langsam aber sicher, dass wir in den Sommer. Na, warm hier unbedingt nicht, hier ist es irgendwie echt nass in Berlin. Es gab einen sehr schönen und interessanten Artikel zum Thema AI, redet ja mal wieder jeder drum. A computer was asked to predict which startups would be successful and the results were astonishing. Die Ausgabe dieses AI-Systems war, wenn man dieses AI-System hätte auswählen lassen, was es denn vor, ich weiß es nicht mehr genau, 10 Jahren hätte investieren sollen und welche Startups denn interessant werden würden, dann, wenn ich das richtig im Kopf habe, wäre dieser Algorithmus, der da entwickelt wurde, der zweitbest performende VC-Fond gewesen.
Wer ist Nummer 1? Weißt du es?
ich weiß es nicht. Ich glaube, es war aber einer der ganz, ganz Großen. Also entweder Sequoia oder Kleiner Perkins. Das, was interessant ist, ist, ich glaube, ich kenne zumindest einen VC in den USA, der tatsächlich probiert, mit so ein bisschen Intelligenz und ein bisschen AI-Einsatz genauso etwas zu machen, also Predictability über welcher Buzz entsteht da gerade, schaffen die Network Effects ja oder nein. Das ist halt etwas, wir reden über VC ist ein sehr unmessbares und sehr, ich sag mal, vielleicht zwar zahlengetrieben, aber schon ein gewisses Risiko, was man da hat. Wenn man das aber tatsächlich schafft, durch Faktoren das Ganze berechenbar zu machen, dann wollen wir natürlich alle gleich wissen, welche die Faktoren sind, weil dann fangen wir alle an zu sagen, wir machen auch AI, wir machen auch ML oder wir sind das Uber für X oder wir sind das Airbnb für Y. Aber es ist schon interessant zu sehen, dass so etwas offensichtlich berechenbar ist.
Ja, das glaube ich schon. Was ich mir schwierig vorstelle, ist halt vor allem die Zeiträume. Bis du weißt, und AI, genauso wie Machine Learning, was ja oft immer in einen Topf geworfen wird, braucht halt auch irgendwie Resultate, um zu wissen, das, was ich da ausgerechnet habe, ist jetzt auch eingetreten, um davon zu lernen. Und ich glaube, da hast du halt schon immer mal ein paar Jahre im Sinne von, der war jetzt wirklich erfolgreich oder eben nicht.
Ja, ich glaube, das ist genau der Punkt. Das ist wieder eine, und da ist auch mein Kritikpunkt an dem Artikel. Im Nachhinein ist das einfach, weil dann hast du alle Datenpunkte und dann kannst du auch klassifizieren, ob die Datenpunkte relevant waren oder auch nicht.
Im Nachhinein habe ich auch Amazon-Aktien gekauft, genau. Aber leider nur im Nachhinein.
Im Nachhinein wusste ich auch schon immer, dass Bitcoin irgendwie bei 50 Trillionen sein wird und habe deshalb irgendwie 100 Bitcoins gemeint am ersten Tag. Ja, es ist genau der Punkt. Also schaffen die das aus diesem Algorithmus, wenn sie den heute loslaufen lassen und wir gucken uns den in 5 Jahren nochmal an, ist der dann immer noch so gut oder taucht er wie leider 80% oder 90% der VCs, taucht er noch nicht mal als Konkurrenz zu einem Sparbuch auf, ja, weil die Returns so mies sind.
Also ich glaube ergänzend, also ich bin jetzt kein VC, aber was ich mir gut vorstellen kann, dass man ergänzend solche Sachen mit reinnimmt und sagt, hey, ich brauche neben meiner normalen Erfahrung, was ich sage, ob das jetzt ein gutes Modell ist oder nicht, nochmal in Anführungsstrichen eine zweite Meinung und die lasse ich noch einfließen, ob ein rein AI-basiertes Modell, das finde ich schon riskant. Ja? Das finde ich vor allem im VC-Business. Das gibt es ja schon öfters im normalen Investment-Business, wo man auch viel schneller merkt, läuft es jetzt oder läuft es nicht. Da kann ich es mir noch eher vorstellen. Gibt es ja klar schon die ersten Fonds, die so laufen und so weiter. Aber das gibt es ja auch schon seit ein paar Jahren. Ne? Also Robo ist ja auch nicht neu, ne? In dem Sinne. Ne?
Stimmt. Gut, ansonsten hatten wir noch ein vielleicht etwas, also zumindest natürlich von unserer Seite, ein wenig diverseren Artikel. Der Digital Chief von der HSBC hat gesagt, there is no existential crisis challenge for banks from Fintech.
Wir haben ja alle mal, haben wir ja heute auch im Podcast ein paar Mal gehört, dass Fintechs immer noch manchmal den Anspruch haben zu sagen, wir sind disruptiv. Fragezeichen, ob das immer der Fall ist. Aber wir haben ja auch gemerkt, dass Fintechs mehr zu einem kooperativen Umgang mit Banken umgegangen sind. Hier die etwas bankerlastigere, vielleicht auch etwas provozierende Aussage, Fintechs werden Banken nicht die Existenz berauben.
Ja, das ist klar. Also ich glaube auch nicht, dass die Bank deswegen verschwinden wird. Also ich glaube, es ist eher so die Diskussion der Relevanz und der Positionierung der Bank in der Value Chain, also Thema Infrastruktur und so weiter, wird sie in den Hintergrund gedrängt. Und ich glaube, die Richtung ging ja eher im Sinne von, verschwinden alle Banken. Nee, das glaube ich auch nicht, dass alle Banken verschwinden. Vielleicht die eine oder andere, aber nicht alle.
Ja, ist halt genau. So ein bisschen überspitzt von beiden Seiten heraus. Also auch der Artikel ist manchmal nicht differenziert genug. Aber eine interessante Meinung auf jeden Fall, dass jemand sich mal hinstellt und sagt, Fintechs werden für mich nicht wirklich bösartig.
Ja. Gut, jo. Ansonsten hatten wir noch ein bisschen PSD2. Rauf und runter, genau. viel im FICO-Kontext oder eben halt zum Thema Screenscraping. Ich habe ehrlich gesagt den Überblick verloren, wie es jetzt genau ausgegangen ist oder wie die Situation ist. Aber wir posten die Links, da kann es jeder lesen.
Ich glaube, die Aussage war ein Jein oder irgendwie so.
Ja, war es glaube ich doch davor auch schon irgendwie. Ja? Das heißt, wir haben uns nicht zur Seite bewegt. Ja?
Genau. Ja. Gut, in diesem Sinne, das war unser Podcast für diese Woche. Kilian, du hast das abschließende Wort.
Ja, danke nochmal auch an die Sponsoren am Payone Temenos, die uns da unterstützen. Jetzt geht es langsam Richtung August. Da werden wir gegebenenfalls einen Wechsel drin haben. Freue mich aber trotzdem da auf die weitere Zusammenarbeit und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Bis zum nächsten Mal. Tschüss.
Ciao.